Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello, you. Thank you so much for downloading Random Access Memories, a retro gaming podcast. Before we dive into this week's episode, I just wanted to thank the fantastic Patreons who support the show financially. They help make it exist. So thank you so much. Thank you to Harsh Singh, Sam Hughes, Craig Hannon and Martin Warren, and the executive producers. They went up to the BBC micro tier, and really, thank you, thank you, thank you. We got some new ones this week. Thanks, as always, to Matt Stanley Evans. Matt's been there from the start. Really appreciate that. Really enjoy reading your emails as well. Mark Gidley and at Woodpunk. Thank you. If you want to support the show, if you want to find out a little bit more, if you want to get the show ad-free before anybody else, then please head over to patreon.com/IanLee. patreon.com/IanLee. Enjoy the show. This is very exciting. Now, this week, I'm joined by Kevin Toms. Now, well, shall we dive straight in to your part in gaming history? I know I there's loads of other stuff that I want to talk about, okay. but let's just set the scene. Your part in gaming history, it is a significant part in gaming history.
Yeah, well, I mean, it was way back in the early days when there wasn't even a shop selling computer games. Everything was like a hobby industry where you had to sell everything by mail order. And I wrote a game which I kind of had an interest in for a long time called Football Manager, the original Football Manager game. And when I brought that out in 1982, having written it in 1981 in Milton Keynes, in a flat in Milton Keynes.
Unlucky. I've worked in Milton Keynes, I know it.
Well, this was... You know, Milton Keynes was still being built then. I started selling it myself by mail order. You know, I basically had written it for interest and because I thought it'd be good. And friends were playing it and they got very hooked on it. And I realized I had something I could sell, spotted the market and started selling by mail order with a quarter page ad in Computer and Video Games magazine. But it was the very first football management game or game of that type.
There will be people, you know, under a certain age who will not believe that one person could do everything. Now, nowadays, yeah. It's games take 10, 15 years. There's hundreds of people working on it. You get some smaller indie games where it's a handful. But back in the day, 1982, the early 80s, it was really common for one person to write the game and then one person to market it and sell it. And were you sending out the cassettes yourself?
Yeah, I was making them. I was actually, if you know back then, they were audio tapes, which you recorded off the computer onto an audio tape. And I literally, when I was preparing to do the advertising and sell the game, I got some simple packaging made with inlay and some instructions. and I bought 300 C60, they were C60s, I think, cassettes from Tandy's at a discount. Yeah. And I was recording them myself. And I used to be sitting in the lounge watching TV. And because it made a noise, and it took about 10 minutes or so, I can't remember, maybe even 15 minutes, I could hear when it ended and switch over to make the next one. So I was literally doing the manufacturing as well.
Can I ask how old you were?
I was 24.
Oh, okay. That was because there were kids doing that stuff around then.
Yeah, I was
as
old.
Well, like teenagers. Well, what computer were you writing them on?
I wrote originally on the TRS-80 clone, the Video Genie. That's what I wrote it first on. I got it all running on that. But then a few months before, in the end of 1981, the ZX81 came out, and I got one of those.
Yeah.
And I thought this is potentially an important market because of the price point. It was £99, and so it was much cheaper. And it was a very, very wise decision because of when I started selling in the new year, of the first 300 I sold, 297 were ZX81 versions and three on the TRS-80 Video Genie. And if I hadn't done the ZX81 version, I wouldn't have been able to pay for the advertising because that was about £100 for each ad.
What were you doing before that? What was young Kevin Toms up to?
Well, that was where it's a funny thing because the way I started is so different to so many because many of them, they got a hold of a home computer and started learning to program it and then wrote games. So they learnt on the home computers. But I was already a professional programmer. I'd been working on mainframes in COBOL and things like that for a few years at that point. And I was actually at that time when I started, I was actually working at the Open University in Milton Keynes doing COBOL programming, I think.
Right. So why again? What was the thought process where you went, you know, I'm going to sit down, I've got an idea, I'm going to sit down at a computer and write all of this out?
Well, it really came because I was inventing games as a hobby young teenager from about 10, 12 years old. I started playing around with writing games, making up games, board games, of course, then. And games with the ball in the street, you know, tennis ball or football, just inventing new games. And I used to, in fact, there's one that people used to play quite a lot, a simple football game with a football, just throwing. Called throwball. I invented it. You had to throw the ball and try and bounce it off the edge of the curb opposite, where there wasn't so many cars, so it was less dangerous. Yeah. And loads of people used to play that.
Used to call that Curbsies where we were. That was Curbsies.
Well, I invented it.
That's fantastic. How many of those tapes did you post out?
When it was mail order, it was hundreds. Because I can remember a point where I was going across the road in Milton Keynes to the post office to send them out in jiffy bags. And there was one day, obviously later on in the year, where I'd got so many that I was carrying 92 of them to the post office that day. And the guy behind the counter who was, oh my God, you know, I've got to deal with these, stamp these all individually. He said, you know, he'd see me come in a number of times, of course, as well. He said, you know, if you've got this many, he said, well, come and collect them. And I said, you will? I had no idea, you know, completely innocent to this stuff. And then after that, they used to call at my little flat and collect the games from me, which I was making. So,
You must have been surprised by the success of it because Football Manager was huge. I grew up with the Dragon 32. I had a BBC Micro, and I really dislike football. I dislike football. However, I would go around to my friend's house and we would play Football Manager together because actually it was you could see it as a football game. You could also see it as kind of like a trading game, a stats game,
a strategy
as well,
game.
Which I was really into. So when it became that big, how did you react?
I was just doing it just day to day. It was just changing. I was adapting all the time. So, it started off, it was just by post-mail order. In fact, when I say about Milton Keynes, I actually got to a point where I was going, I'd already, they were building some offices down the road. Everything's being built in Milton Keynes. They're building some new office block, and I'd registered for one. I suddenly thought, oh no, I'm going to be, once I get an office and staff and that, I'm going to be in Milton Keynes. That's where I am. And I never saw myself as permanently there. I mean, I grew up by the beach in Torquay, and I was missing the, you know, being closer to the ocean. And so I decided I've got to move now before I build this up. And that's how I moved to, relocated to Bournemouth. And then it grew there. So it started off in Milton Keynes. It was all me. And then when I went down to Bournemouth, I started recruiting staff and it started to grow. But it was really just dealing with like things as they happened, you know, like suddenly bigger sales. You know, when WH Smith made their big order in the autumn, I knew I couldn't make 2,000 games myself. And so I had to get a manufacturer. Luckily, there was a company that started manufacturing games at that point, because there were plenty of people who could duplicate audio cassettes, but they couldn't make them right for games. They wouldn't load. So it was a specialist that just one company did at first, until others learned how to do it.
Were you a gamer or were you purely a programmer?
I mean, I used to like playing games, but I find the writing of them more fun, you know.
Now, for those who don't know, I'm ADHD. I got diagnosed. I'm 50. I got diagnosed about 2 years ago. Completely changed my life. Suddenly, it made sense of, you know, I used to be called thick and naughty at school by the teachers because I just couldn't. I'd go in a classroom and go, right, I'm really going to focus. And within 5 minutes, I'm bouncing off the wall. The ADHD has explained that. It's explained why I'm not particularly great at relationships, in part. And it's a really big part of my life and something I talk about a lot. And we've been emailing each other, Kevin, and your ADHD. You still there? Just as we're getting to the good stuff. You're back.
Yeah, we just got a glitch. That's unbelievable.
Sorry, glitches are okay. Your ADHD, tell me a bit about when you got diagnosed and what that was like for you.
A major revelation and has changed a lot of things. I got diagnosed only about 3 years ago. And
okay.
I think... a lot of people that were diagnosed, not as children, but late in adulthood, end up experiencing, I almost swore then, try not to swear, why didn't I know before? It would have changed so many things. I've done so many things differently. I know some people even get quite grief-struck by that. I haven't, because I feel glad that I was diagnosed, because everything has changed for the better since. It's made my life much more stable, and things that, just much more stable and progressive rather than erratic, because there's an erraticness or impulsiveness, and you know, there's many consequences, and now I don't have those problems anymore. I can still feel the symptoms sometimes, but I can recognize
them. This is too personal, then tell me to jog on. Are you taking medication for it?
Yeah, I take medication. And I don't mind talking about it.
Okay.
Because that in itself, in fact, I've learned a lot about it. And one of the things is it's one of the most, in terms of medication for a condition like this, it's one of the most effective medications, you know, for things that affect you psychologically. So I do. And it's very effective.
I tried the medication. It didn't. I'm a recovering drug addict, and there was just something about taking something that was amphetamine based that just made me feel a little bit uncomfortable. So I tried it. It didn't work for me, and I'm a big advocate of coping techniques, coming up with ways to make things more productive. And I'm kind of jealous of people like you where it has worked. I know so many people who have gone, oh my God, once I started taking the meds, everything changed. How has the medication affected your life for the better?
More calm. That's the odd thing, because it's a stimulant, isn't it? So it seems to work the other way. It doesn't, coffee's affect me more in that way. But concentration, focus, patience, you know, like being able to listen to people better, not interrupting. I've met, you know, I've talked to other people who have been diagnosed, and they said, you know, what about the medication? I said, you'll be interrupting people less. I said, that's one of one of the things that comes out of it, and you'll listen better. For me, it's like changed what was like I always describe as a kind of zigzag life to a more of a steady progression, and you know, getting things done better. Just a lot of good
things. The listening is a tough. For 20 years, I was a phone-in radio host, and my job was to talk. And if I didn't talk, I wouldn't get paid.
Yeah.
And now I've retrained as a counselor, as a therapist. Mm-hmm. And the most important thing I had to learn was to shut up and to listen. You know, instead of the head going off, you know, thinking about what's the difference between an African and an Indian elephant or whatever. You know, how old was George Harrison when he left the Beatles? He was 27. Instead of doing that, when I'm sat with a client, I have to be present and I have to listen. And I've taught myself for the hour, I can do that. And then after the hour, I kind of have to shake it all out. But that was a big thing for me, was I would not be listening to what someone was saying to me. I would be thinking what the next thing I was going to say was. And
yeah,
people would notice it. They would think it was rude. Yes. They would think I wasn't paying attention. But it was just how I was wired. So being able to listen to someone and respond to it,
yeah,
is a big thing to learn.
I think that there's this thing that happens is that your mind makes a lot of fast connections, you know, and things trigger. So there's like lots of patterns. I don't know whether it's because of ADHD. I think it might be. So like when somebody says something, you think, there's something good I want to say about that. That's really good. And then the other thing I believe, is that because you know that if you don't do it right away, you'll forget it and you'll lose this great thing that you've come up with. You want to say it straight away. Mm-hmm. Now, to you, that's because you're excited about it and because you think it's really worthwhile. And it can mean you're great company because you can be very stimulating and jokey and fun and everything. But the other person can perceive it as not allowing them to speak, you know, and you don't know you're doing it. And I think that can be very easily misread, you know. Like,
I have the greatest thing I ever did. You can't quite see it here, but I stuck a whiteboard up next to the computer. So if I'm doing something online or if I'm working with a client sometimes and an idea comes, just write it up on there. Now, most of it, I don't remember what any of it means. However, the simple act, this is one of my coping mechanisms, the simple act of writing something down can be enough just to get it out or as a reminder of something that I want to look up or investigate further. How are you with the ADHD tax, the buying stuff, starting new hobbies, and then when it comes going, what did I buy that for? You any good with that?
Oh, yeah. I think the other things, if I was to say what shows looking back as well, is the fact that I've lived in 7 countries and I can remember moving 14 times in 10 years. And I also spent a long time as a contractor, an independent contractor. That suited me because I would change jobs quite regularly every few months. But staying long term in a permanent job, when somebody described that, there's a friend of mine, he was worked 4.5 years with one company, and I said, what are you doing? And he described it, and I said, that's really boring. I said, how do you cope with that? He said, well, they're paying me. And I just thought, no, I couldn't handle it. Yeah. I just wouldn't be able to do it, even though they're paying me well. I mean, I just would need change, need some stimulation.
Moved 14 times. Moving is my literal nightmare. I have nightmares that I have to be out of a house within an hour and I've got to pack everything. But you enjoy the moves?
No.
It's okay.
There's always a reason. There's always a justification. I'm doing it for a purpose. But when it's only when looking back at it, and with moving countries as well, that part of it as well. But looking back at it, I thought that was a lot in a short time. And I think that's just one of a, you might say, a symptom. But you don't know it's a symptom. because you're too clever at coming up with reasons why you're doing what you're doing when it's really a need for... I did think actually that I was getting, because of the need for stimulation, I was getting the benefit of having to start somewhere new all the time, you know, having to have to deal with fresh challenges all the time. And that was something I wanted. But yeah.
It's interesting you mentioned the jobs. I hadn't considered that. When I worked in TV, the most you work on a job in TV is 3 months and then you're off to something else. And you've reminded me, I trained to be an actor. I went to university and did performing arts. And the plan was to become an actor. And we'd have to do shows there. And quite often we would do the shows 4 times. And by the third time, I was so bored of doing the same, saying the same words again. It was almost physically painful having to repeat that. And I was so scared when I was young. I grew up in Slough, and we were trained in schools, in the school, basically to go into the Slough trading estate and work in offices. No disrespect to anyone who's worked in an office. I've done it. I used to get so depressed and scared, Kevin, that that would be my life because of the boredom, the repetition.
Yeah.
I couldn't handle that. And it's really interesting that you bring that up as something.
Yeah, no, I think it's true. I can also remember I worked at, I was doing a job at Torbay Borough Council in Torquay. And I met a guy and he was working in the rates department. And he said, he was only in his 30s, I think, maybe late 30s or something. He said, I've been here for 16 years, he said. And everything he emanated was he didn't like his job. And I can remember I was only like 18 or something like that at the time. I thought of that as complete nightmare life, you know, like I couldn't imagine that, you know. So it's like how you judge it, because, I mean, other people might say, oh, that's very stable, you know, and you know, and predictable. And they might like that.
Yeah.
But to me, that seemed like alarming and really feel like dying. I would felt like I died if I was him.
How are you with noise? One of the things that I used to be a joke between me and my partner is if we're in a restaurant or at a party, I can't hear what the person opposite me is saying because of the hubbub. I can't separate the noise. It's just one thing. And we used to joke about it. And then I got diagnosed and read a book, and it said that that is a thing that some people who have ADHD struggle with, is separation of noise. How are you with sound?
I have a different version of it. I actually find the complete silence a problem. And so one of the things I do, which people don't understand, is I often, you know, like I work on software, and I often like to do that in a cafe. You know, where, right. you know, I'm struggling because I want to say coffee shop, and that means something else here.
You're in Amsterdam, by
the way. That's right. I mean, Amsterdam and coffee shop has a different meaning. I would have normally said coffee shop. So, and the very fact that there are people moving around and there's stuff going on is relaxing for me, and it doesn't distract me at all. It gives me focus, in fact, and silence makes me restless. Sitting in a quiet room, well, it's more likely to make me restless if I don't have some noise on. So I have a different way of reaction. It is reacting, but it's reacting preferring stimulation as background, noise as background.
What do you have? Do you have to have the radio on to fall asleep?
No. I've got,
you can do that silence.
I've got a good mastery of that now. Yeah. I've become very good at sleep, actually. Yeah.
Really?
Years of practice. Yeah. Years of practice.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
That sounds good, doesn't it?
What were you like at school? Looking back, and you talked about the grief. I run some ADHD workshops as well, and you're right, the grief that people look back and see perhaps wasted opportunities, wasted relationships.
Yes.
When you look back at your school years, how do you feel about that, and what were you like?
School was tough for me. I don't know how much I was affected. I mean, it would have been affected. It must have affected me. But I was people find this very hard to understand if they meet me now, but I was a particularly shy person when I was at school. I had, you know, very little self-confidence. I think I felt different. I think that was, you know, I felt abnormal, you know, so I was, you know, I mean, it was like a different experience school, really.
I've heard it described by people, and this fits perfectly, that they missed, it's like they missed the day or the week at school where people were taught how to have small talk and how to socialise properly. Because I have struggled with small talk my whole life. Again, I'm really, really shy. And, you know, you look back at my CV, you can't be. I've had to learn the script for small talk because I don't know how you do it. So I've learned that you ask people how they are. You ask people how their family are. You ask them what they do for a living. I've had to learn that. And I watch people at parties, and I don't really go to parties, but I watch other people interacting and meeting people and think, how do they do that? How are they not completely clenched up in terror and completely uncomfortable feeling?
Yeah, well, I mean, I have different challenges there in that I can't. They'll tell me everything about themselves, and then I won't remember it.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, here's the one. How are you with faces and names? Do you recognize faces? Can you remember
I've
names?
I've actually just. I mean, it's like, you know, all my problems. But I was listening to Emily Maitlis on a podcast earlier on, and she suffers from the same thing as I do: facial blindness. It's a huge challenge. So I can't recognize people until I've seen them a few times. And so it helps if they're wearing a name badge or something. But I think it's unrelated, but it's remembering someone's name, very hard as well.
It is common with ADHD. What's it? I think it's called prosopagnosia or something, the facial blindness.
Okay.
I have it. I used to say, oh, nice to meet you. And people would say, oh, we worked together 6 months ago. And it can come across as arrogant. So now I've learned the line of, have we met? We've met, haven't we? And then if you're right, fantastic. And if you're wrong, you look like a slightly bumbling thing. But I do think it is part of ADHD.
Well,
is for a lot of the people I've worked with.
Oh, okay, that's very interesting. Because, yeah, I mean, I didn't know there was a link, but... yeah, it's a real problem because, you know, you might have spent quite some time talking to someone and they meet you again and they recognize you immediately and you're thinking, I can't think who this person is. I know I've met them before, but that's all I remember. I can't remember the context, can't remember the name, and they might have spent quite a bit of time with you. It's very annoying. So that's where it's socially very, very problematic, isn't it? Because you feel like you're being rude. You know, and it's kind of worse for me as well because I'm 6'5" and you know, so distinct looking as well. So people always remember me because I'm, you know, so tall. I always say I wish they would all have different color hair or something like that so I could remember the person with the blue hair. So like,
it's interesting you mentioned being recognized. Going back to the game,
because
you brilliantly, this is a stroke of genius, you put your face on the cover of the game, Kevin Tom's Football Manager.
Yeah.
And there's a picture of you, big bushy hair, big beard.
Yeah.
I don't think that had ever been done before.
No, and I thought it was very predictable at the time because what was happening was, I mean, I'd written the game and I was, you know, selling it by mail order and I started attending computer game shows. And there was one or two game shows I went to and I was talking to people about the game and they were people who played it, you know, so they actually played it and then they'd say something and I say, oh, the reason I did that it was because of so-and-so and they say, what, you wrote the game? And I said, yeah. And they thought I was a salesman. So I said, yeah. And then they got really animated and everything and started asking me a lot more. And I thought, well, you know, hang on. This is, although I'm selling this thing in a cassette, it's my design, my way of writing it. And you know, obviously, I just saw an analogy with music and books. I just thought, nobody cares what record label a band is on. It's the band you like because you like the style of music. Yeah. The same with an author of books. You like the way he wrote that book. You'd like to buy another book by him. And I thought, surely computer games is the same, especially as I'd written it entirely myself as well. And I thought that way people will know it's mine. And also I'm, in a way, giving credibility to it. Say, I'm prepared to put my name to this game. Yeah. I think it's good. And luckily it was good.
Very good. Very good. I met you very briefly at kind of a retro gaming. I've just dived back into the retro gaming thing after flirting on the fringes. Met you very briefly at an event in somewhere West London, something like that. And you go to these events and give talks, and then people come up and ask for photos and get you to sign their copy of Football Manager.
Yeah.
That's incredible that 40 years later, your game and so many of those games still stand the test of time and have a huge following. I imagine that's very flattering for you.
Yeah, and it was like, you know, I knew the game so well. I knew people liked it. But it was really the age of the internet that really brought that back to me. Because people, you know, like I was online and people started contacting me and talking to me about playing my game and everything. And I realized more and more that it was more than just a game, that it had a big impact on people's lives. I mean, part of their lives in the same way as, you know, music is, and, you know, it's part of a cultural kind of thing, is to play a lot with their friends. Of course, they, you know, more than a song, you don't play it for 12 hours, the same song, you know, like, but they do play games and play with their friends, like you said, with your friends as well. So it's a social thing as well.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I'm appreciative of that, and I like people, so it's nice to do that and talk about it as well.
Going back to the ADHD, for those that don't know, one of the many great things about ADHD is the hyperfocus, and it's where our brains and our focus can zoom in on one thing, and we can do it 4, 5, 6, 7 hours.
Yeah.
I'm so lucky. If my partner phones up when I'm in a hyperfocus, I just say, can't talk now, hyperfocus, and she brilliantly goes, give me a call when it's done. Mm-hmm. Now, for the most part, for me, it's cable management. It's tidying up. It's quite often it involves tidying, and I'm really hoping I get it soon for the garage because I need to work on that. But it can be work, it can be writing, it can be podcasting, it can be streaming. And I'm wondering, looking back, was hyperfocus, did that play a part in you writing the game?
Yeah, I think it always has. I think I certainly experience it now still. And I love it, actually. But yeah, no, I can get lost. I mean, you know, writing software, and still writing the new games today, I do experience that. I think in the last week I did, when I was in the cafe, and you know, for about four and a half hours, I think I was there working away, and just got interrupted for lunch. But I would have happily carried on for the rest of the afternoon. You know, sort of.
It's a great feeling when you're locked
it's
in.
It's peaceful.
It really is.
Yeah, nothing else matters, and of course all that's going on around me, but I don't notice. So, it's not good if you're trying to monitor something. But if it doesn't matter, it's great. It's great, yeah.
What happened with... So Football Manager, huge success. Football Manager 2, what was the progress?
Football Manager 2 was very successful, actually. But it wasn't so pleasant for me to do. It was the number one seller for 3 months continuously.
Wow.
And sold lots of games. But the experience of writing it, where I was no longer, you know, writing all, you know, just on my own, I had a team of guys doing graphics all around the country, and it was a more stressful experience. But so I produced a good game, but I don't feel it the same way as I feel the original one,
right?
Writing of the original one.
Looking back on all the games, the way the business progressed, would you have done anything differently, do you think?
Oh, absolutely.
Go on.
Well, hindsight is 20/20 vision. Actually, you know, we've been talking about ADHD. It might have affected the way I was making decisions, because the most obvious thing I would do now, and I would probably think of it that way now, is I would, because Football Manager, the original Football Manager, was successful, I would think, okay, how can I incrementally develop that further? But I switched to doing other things. I switched to doing another game about software, which was a good game, and I did a president, and then eventually, not until I'd sold the company, did I get back to Football Manager 2. So I would have just carried on a steady progression and not think I need to do something completely different, which is the kind of way I was reacting at the time. And that would have been a better choice. The one bit of information I was lacking, which would have helped me, is that now with the internet, you can get direct communication back. Then all I would get was the occasional letters or meet somebody at a show. The sales were there, but I didn't get that sort of so much of the sense of what it was meaning to people and how committed they were to the game and what their thoughts were about the game, like I might do now, where they say, you know, could we have this? Could we have that? You know, is this possible? Is that not possible? But that was just one that wasn't available to me at that time anyway. Didn't have that information. So that would have affected my thinking as well. Yeah.
Still writing games? I have a Kevin Toms Football Manager on my phone. Is that the most recent?
That is. So what I did there was a few years ago. I was in Canada at the time, one of my travels. And I put out online, I said, you know, I do mobile software, you know, for iOS and Android. And I could rewrite my original game for mobile. Is anybody interested? And I got a very positive reaction. And so I started on it. And then I spent, I think it was about 18 months in total writing that. And then it was basically a complete fresh write of the original Football Manager game, but for mobiles. So it is a very strong retro feel. It has the gameplay is very, very close, but I didn't need to look at the code or anything in the original. I just wrote it from scratch because I knew how it played. And I've enhanced it a bit. And people play it a lot. They literally play hundreds of seasons on that game. And then it just got to a point a few years back, or a couple of years back now, where people were starting to ask for more features. I was adding some, which I felt were worth it. And then I said, look, if I start adding that kind of feature, I'm changing the game. Do you want me to do that? And the general response, most people said, no, it's kind of a classic design. Keep that. No, don't do that. I said, well, I'm going to start a new project then. So that's what the other football management game I do is. It's called Kevin Todd's Football Game at the moment. And that's one thing I found was, because of all the different football type games, putting my name on the front, funny enough, it kind of links right back to doing it in the region when I did it the first time, is the best way for people to find my game. So, you know, when they look for Kevin Toms on the App Store, they can find my App Store, they can find my game. So this one, though, that I'm writing now, I've got a released version. It's like a minimum viable game that's on the App Stores. It's free to download and, you know, it's advertising supported. But I've got another version, like the next version in the works, and I'm deciding at the moment whether to release that interim version or do a kind of a version 2 in the new year, in January, probably.
Yeah.
But it's evolving nicely, that game. And that's a long-term evolution product. So, like, I'll keep the straightforward gameplay that I do. I'm not going to add lots and lots of statistics or anything like that, because that's for someone else to do. But I focus on the gameplay and the fun and the pick-up and play. I mean, one of the things that got me to do it was people who used to play my original game say they don't want the big complex stuff, you know, that the other football manager might say is now.
Yeah.
They say because they haven't got the time. And, you know, they just need something they can just play and get back to. But, of course, you get the save game, so you can always continue from where you left off. So the Football Style Manager, or Kevin Toms Football Manager, is a rewrite. Kevin Toms Football Game is a new evolution.
Kevin, we're done. I want to say thank you. Thank you for coming on this. And also thank you for writing those games, for making Football Manager back in the early 80s, because I had so much fun playing it. Say, I'm not a football fan, didn't like it, but I had so much fun playing that game. And, you know, also, you guys, you are the pioneers of video game making. You helped shape the industry. You helped make home computers what they were. If there weren't people like you turning out games of that quality, it could have gone a different way. So thank you so much, Kevin, for everything you've done. It's really appreciated.
Thanks. I appreciate that. Yeah, we weren't thinking about movie licenses or anything like that. We were just thinking of those days of how to write another good game. And I think that was a good drive we had in those early days.
Fantastic.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Really nice to meet you properly.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you so much for downloading Ian Lee's Random Access Memories, a retro gaming podcast. Do check out the Patreon, patreon.com/IanLee, IAINLEE. And also go to my YouTube channel and look for the Random Access Memories there. Again, it's youtube.com/IanLee. Thanks for downloading.